Hello, boys and girls. Welcome in to the Boys and Girl Podcast with Cowboys NFL Network reporter Jane Slater and NFL Network producer Bobby Belt. A Cowboys community with the inside scoop on the Dallas Cowboys. Now, coming straight to you from the Lone Star State, here's Jane and Bobby.
All right, we finally got here. We are talking football, Cowboys, Rams at SoFi Stadium on Sunday night. This is one I'm looking forward to and one I've circled on my calendar. Unfortunate that we have limited travel restrictions right now at the NFL Network, and I will not be there. But that doesn't mean we won't have one of my colleagues, Omar Ruiz, joining us here in a bit just to give us a sense of what fans can expect from SoFi Stadium and this matchup from the Rams viewpoint. But also, I mean, there are some hot takes in sports, and then there's some absurd ones, and justifiably so. One of those particular takes was a take by Skip Bayless. We, of course, are here on Fox Sports Radio. He, of course, is one of the co-hosts on Undisputed. But just such an irresponsible take that because Dak admitted in a sit-down interview with Graham Bensinger that he was struggling with depression as relates to COVID and then the death of his brother Jace, that he sought help and that somehow that admission was a competitive disadvantage for his team and showed poor leadership. So we'll dig in with that with one of my favorite reporters on the beat, Jory Epstein with USA Today. Bobby.
Yeah, excited to talk to Jory. Really excited to talk to Omar. I got to say, we're going to preview this Rams-Cowboys game. It doesn't feel real yet. You know, this whole time, like leading up to the season, there's been a little. I remember there was a time where I wasn't totally remembering who the Cowboys were even opening against back in July. I had to ask somebody. I was like, "Who do they open the season against?" Because there's
not
just almost,
the Giants.
Yeah, exactly. There's almost just this disbelief that the season was even going to happen. And so now that we've got one game under our belt with the Chiefs and Texans, and heading into this game the Cowboys have against the Rams, it's just a little surreal. It doesn't feel like we're quite there yet. But I'm sure once, you know, things kick off on Sunday night, it won't take long for fans to adjust and be, you know, just as ready to fire off their hot takes about fire McCarthy because they ran the ball there, or like, you know, don't re-sign Dak because that's one incompletion. Now that'll all return to Twitter on Sunday night.
Oh, poor Deshaun Watson already got it after his performance on Thursday.
Man, yeah, that was brutal. But I mean, you know, we have that to look forward to next year, I guess, with Dak if contract gets done, which I'm sure it will, but we'll have that discussion with Jory as well.
I'm excited to welcome in my Pro Bowl companion, my colleague at NFL Network, who also happens to cover the Chargers and the Rams out there in LA. It is Omar Ruiz. You can find him on Twitter at Omar D. Ruiz. You have had an incredibly busy offseason, not only covering sort of the ins and outs of SoFi Stadium and its development, but congratulations. I already love your two daughters, but you've added a third daughter. You are the truest of true girl dads.
It's an amazing feat, Jane. You know, to go three for three there with the girls, and it is girl dad, and it's our daily lives are fascinating in that I'll take Isabella to the backyard. We'll do batting practice. She gets excited about hitting home runs, and then without skipping a beat, I want to go put my princess dress on now, and then her and Aviana will play with their Disney castle, and they just go seamlessly. So girl dad for life, and couldn't be happier that Livia is, you know, so loved on by her two big sisters. It's been a fun summer, you know, despite, you know, all the limitations we had, not being able to go out and, you know, go to Disneyland. But if we can bring a little Disneyland here, it's all good.
You guys are truly the best. And honestly, it's been remarkable to watch you get some of that time because you are one of our reporters that is typically so incredibly mobile. I mean, I feel like you're always on the road. But one of the stadiums that you've obviously had an opportunity to check out so far is SoFi Stadium. I mean, AT&T Stadium, when it came to be what it's almost now 10 years or a little bit over 10 years now, was sort of the creme de la creme. And then, of course, we got the Vikings in that stadium, which is incredibly impressive. How impressive is SoFi?
It's unbelievable. It's almost surreal when you look at the stadium, the sight lines, and, you know, I've been in there three times maybe the last 4 or 5 weeks, and every different vantage point is better than the next. Every different luxury suite that we've been introduced to is cooler than the previous one.
which they're calling bungalows, right?
Yeah, bungalows and cabanas they have there. Exactly. We also took a trip into the owner's suite where Stan Kroenke is going to have access to. It's leathered marble, they call it, straight from Italy, in the bar and eating area there. And so, I mean, it's cool. But I think as luxurious as some of it is, for, you know, the fans that are sitting in what we used to consider the nosebleed seats, they have a vantage point that is just as good as any I've seen from the top of the stadium. So they really made it accessible and advantageous for all the fans there, which is really cool. But in talking to one of the designers and architects, they really look at stadium designs before and after Jerry World. You know, the stadium in Dallas really set the marker for what stadiums could be and test the boundaries and limitations for these architects. And I think SoFi Stadium really is a testament to that. And it's fascinating. Can't wait to see it, not only with real competition on Sunday, but then when the fans fill it up eventually, what that'll look like too.
Before we get in the matchup, I wanted to ask you, so we saw, I was actually texting our boss during the game, Todd Sperry, and I said, is this the fake fan noise or is this real fans? Because there were 17,500 fans at the game last night, and it sounded pretty good because at the blue and white scrimmage game, we heard for the first time the fake noise, which I joked was sort of like a mix between a babbling brook meets a music fest without the music.
Yeah,
it was just, it's jarring. Have you heard it yet at SoFi? Because last night I'm told that was actually real fan noise. That wasn't the fake fan noise. So fans, especially Cowboys fans and Rams fans, you haven't heard the fake fan noise yet. And of course at SoFi, no fans.
Yeah, I haven't heard it there. I know the Rams have been practicing with that steady decibel level at 85, which is about 10 decibel levels more than what's going to be allowed. I think it'll be in that 70 to 75 range. And Sean McVay hates it. You know, most of the Rams say it's annoying, and that relentless hum is more annoying. But, you know, obviously they're trying to be respectful to cadence calls and audibles and all of this and that, trying to make it as real as possible, given the limitations. But, you know, each team's prepping for it. And I too, Jane, I was impressed with how loud the Chiefs fans were able to be. I think a real testament to how loud they actually are. Obviously, one of the loudest venues in the NFL when they have the stadium full. So to be that loud and make such an impact, at least to the microphones that were there on the field, it was certainly impressive.
So the Rams will take the field on Sunday with a brand new highest paid player at his position, with Jalen Ramsey getting the big deal. I guess that's the first thing fans have been wondering about and chattering about. And obviously teams seem to be a lot more secretive this year leading up to the regular season, given the limited access that is allowed at practice and things like that across the league. So what's your anticipation? Do you think Jalen Ramsey is trailing Amari Cooper most of the game, or are they just going to let him play a certain side?
I would expect him to line up everywhere. I think the focus of Brandon Staley, the new defensive coordinator for the Rams, is to involve Jalen Ramsey as a playmaker, to sort of transcend that lockdown corner, that playmaking DB. I think what we've seen over the years is whenever you have a dominant shutdown corner that takes away one half of the side, that's exactly what he does. And then the offense just sort of curtails their attack to the other side. Well, you're taking, you know, one of your best players out of the game plan, and obviously that's by design. So I think what the Rams want to do is just put Ramsey in a position to make plays and to not just shut down one half, but really have him be an aggressive playmaker. And I think that's a testament to his skill set. It's also a testament to the trust and the faith that they have in John Johnson back there at safety, and the freedom that his knowledge and his leadership, not necessarily a household name yet, but for Rams fans, they certainly know about him and all the impact he made in that Super Bowl run a couple of seasons ago, coming off an injury. But I think having the trust and ability of him will allow them to have Jalen Ramsey roam, whether it's trailing Amari, whether it's taking one half of the field. I think we'll see Ramsey used in a variety of ways.
With that being said, the Cowboys do, you know, obviously one of the league's best offenses last year, and that was without a guy like CeeDee Lamb and the use of Blake Jarwin, which a lot of people argued should have been on the field more. in the place of Jason Witten. How do you see them schematically trying to attack this offense? And, you know, we've joked, it's pick your poison with the Cowboys. But when you look at sort of the scouting reports and just the thoughts on CeeDee Lamb and what he's been able to do. And of course, you've got a guy like Mike McCarthy who spent a year away from the game studying a lot of what Sean McVay and what he was doing. How do you see them schematically trying to defend this Cowboys offense?
It's a great question. I think, you know, kind of to Bobby's point, you know, how secretive they've tried to be. I think they're going to be aggressive. I think that's one of, you know, Staley's tenets is, you know, how aggressive, how attacking he wants that defense to be as opposed to reactive in nature. And so I think, you know, the question for the Rams heading in is, you know, how much of it is going to be still Kellen Moore? How much of it is going to be Mike McCarthy? McVay even, you know, talked about Joe Philbin and his influence in that building on that offense. So in talking to McVay last week, he told me, listen, we don't want to overthink it. You know, obviously we don't have the preseason. We don't have any sort of indication or clue. It sounds a lot like an approach you'd hear from a team at the Super Bowl. And, you know, they lay out the game plan that first week, and then they get to the second week. They do their practice. They do their walkthroughs. But then they start telling themselves, you don't want to overthink it because we have been preparing this for 2 weeks. Obviously, they've been preparing since the schedule came out for the Cowboys. They don't want to overthink it at this point. And I think their big focus, aside from the newness of this Cowboys offense, is their newness within that defense and how they're going to play. And they want to sort of be focused on, for the first time, playing together in that Brandon Staley offense to be 100% focused on what they do well. Let Aaron Donald, you know, do what he does best and be disruptive everywhere. Jalen Ramsey in that role that we talked about, you know, just how, you know, multifaceted that will be and communicative with each other with all the different calls that they're going to have. So they're sort of prepared for everything from the Cowboys standpoint while focused on being the best they can be here in their debut with a new defensive coordinator.
The biggest change outside of obviously, you know, you've got new defensive coordinator there, no Dante Fowler anymore. The Cowboys will see John Johnson this time. They did not see him in the last game last year where Dallas kind of took it to the Rams in that one. But the biggest difference from the last several years will be there's no Todd Gurley in this offense. There's no Todd Gurley to game plan from Dallas's side. It's going to be sort of a three-headed monster is what it sounds like, doing the running back by committee, Malcolm Brown, their second-round pick, Cam Akers, and then Daryl Henderson, who they took in the third round in 2019, who's been dealing with a hamstring thing this week, but apparently has been a full participant. How different do you think the offense will look with no Todd Gurley? Is it just going to be there's going to be a rotation of personnel acting as if the way they use Todd Gurley, or are they going to change the way they use the running back now that they don't have him?
Well, I would expect Cam Akers to kind of, you know, take that step here, at least early on, given what you mentioned with Daryl Henderson and kind of nursing that hamstring throughout training camp. Yeah, I expect him to play on Sunday, but the fact that he has really been inactive the last couple of weeks in practice, and Cam Akers in his own right has been impressive since they started the virtual training. And I think, you know, one of the anecdotes in talking to Rams coaches is that when rookies get into the building and they're in those huge group meetings in the auditorium or maybe the giant classroom, rookies might be a little intimidated to express themselves, to ask questions. They don't want to sound dumb in front of their veteran teammates. But with the Zoom structure in OTAs and the virtual offseason, maybe that wasn't there, you know, that sort of, you know, shyness for rookies weren't there. And Cam Akers was one of those players who from the get was just, you know, engaged, asking questions from a mental standpoint, trying to get as much out of that virtual offseason as he could. And so that certainly was reflective on how he looked there on the field once they hit the ground running and got into the physical training camp here during August. So he's been impressive at every marker. And that's included, you know, how he's played, the physicality that they drafted him for. So all that said, I would expect him to be the lead dog amongst that running back by committee. And I know in years past, they sort of structured, you know, their blocking schemes and everything to Gurley's skill set. But it might have been a little different than what McVay used to run in Washington. Now, obviously, this is year four for him. And so his offense has evolved anyway. And I would expect it to evolve once again based on what these three running backs can do versus what Todd Gurley brought to the table in his own right.
One last question before we let you go. As comprehensive as that was, mine has something to do with HBO and Hard Knocks. One of my favorite series that we had in Dallas was All or Nothing and sort of getting the behind the scenes, because even as a reporter, you see a lot, you hear a lot, but you're not always, you know, behind closed doors. Especially this year, I felt like while we didn't get those amazing, like, off the field storylines, how interesting was it for you just to see what was going on as it related to COVID when training camp opened up and stuff that we weren't able to see because we're not allowed in these facilities or at training camp to watch practice?
Absolutely fascinating. It's a really good point. And I think one of my big takeaways from that Hard Knocks experience in watching the behind the scenes of Andrew Whitworth and Aaron Donald and Jalen Ramsey, all these guys that we hear all the time, what great leaders they are. And Sean McVay always says, your best players are your best people and all of that. To see that on display, even without COVID and those limitations, we don't really get to see that behind the scenes tutelage that these veterans offer the younger players and the time they spend after practice showing them how to, you know, develop their technique and to get better as players and as people. And we saw Andrew Whitworth doing that with some of the younger linemen. We saw Jalen Ramsey doing that with Van Jefferson, who's, you know, kind of gone through the roof here with his expectations in training camp. So, that was really neat. And Aaron Donald, I think, you know, they've run out of words to describe him here in L.A. and really in the NFL. The other day, Sean McVay says every day in practice, he does something where he says, you know, holy bleep, you know, because, you know, he is so impressive every single day. And, you know, that leadership that he showed in Hard Knocks, in addition to the, you know, all the physical stuff and the mental side of the game that he has command of, it's all so impressive. So, but it was a good point, you know, that you brought up with the Hard Knocks and all the behind the scenes stuff that we don't normally have access to, which was really cool.
Well, you are impressive, my friend. So is your wife, Ashley Ruiz, but behind every good man is a very impressive woman. My still favorite was the fact that we went to Pro Bowl last year. We had to get on the Mandalorian, which was the most epic ride. And she got to the park with us at 6 o'clock in the morning while she was heavily pregnant. I'm really disappointed that you didn't go with Covita as the name for your child. We discussed that.
Covita Quarantina.
Covita Quarantina is what we were going to go with. But I just, she's such a boss. I mean, she literally, we didn't wrap that day until midnight. And then we still ended up doing TV the next day. I mean, you guys, the best family, one of the best colleagues. Thanks for joining the show.
Well, we couldn't have done it without you, Jane, kind of pushing us and, you know, making sure we were inspired by Baby Yoda.
Yes.
And thanks for telling me that season two of Mandalorian was coming out. I showed the girls your message. They were so excited to hear that, you know, Baby Yoda will be back, but then so disappointed. You know, kids, they don't know what a month and a half, you know, wait's going to be for that. So, but I said right before Halloween. So we have an extra special, you know, Halloween this year with season two of Mandalorian.
And how about the admission before I let you go, because we geek out so much on Star Wars, that the one was just going to be a puppet that they didn't know how much they were going to use and how much he was going to be making an impact on the Mandalorian. And now he's going to be a focal point. How much did I try to find just merch while I was at?
It's unbelievable how, you know, sometimes, you know, the best circumstances are out of pure luck and you know, you can plan and they can do marketing and the testing of all of this. But until they actually, you know, put a show out there, put a character out there, how he just exploded and became maybe one of the more talked about characters in all of pop culture, you know, this last couple of years. And we've seen him kind of, you know, in sports, you know, with being a little mascot for teams. And you know, for us, we love him, not only, you know, the new generation of Star Wars fans like my kids, but even us, you know, have a great appreciation for, you know, little Baby Yoda. So, yeah, it's pretty wild that he was just going to be a side character. And now, you know, he's the star.
Nobody puts my baby in a corner. Hot take, the most iconic Star Wars character. You are Never. The best, Omar. I appreciate you so much. All right, we are now joined by superstar reporter Jory Epstein with USA Today. You can find her at Jory Epstein, a University of Texas alumna and someone who has moved through the ranks so quick on this Dallas beat by virtue of you do such a good job of really connecting with these players, Jory. Your relentless relationships with them are something that have always stood out to me. And you're one of those on the beat that has this dynamic relationship with Dak. I get the sense that Dak really trusts you. Have you talked to Dak about some of these comments that have come out in the wake of his admission of dealing with depression and the loss of his brother, Jace?
I mean, specifically when it relates to Jace, more so in the group setting that we've all been into, but I think that his line has pretty much been the same, and we've just seen Dak everything one at a time. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's his contract, losing his mom, losing his brother. It doesn't matter what goes wrong. He just owns it. And that was why it was almost a little bit ironic that someone could say like, oh, he's being vulnerable. That's a sign of weakness. Because if you know Dak, you know that anytime he has adversity, he transforms it into a strength, whether it's, oh, my mom died of cancer. Well, now I'm going to help fund cancer research. I'm trying to think of all the other examples. Oh, I'm biracial and my parents had this like tricky history. Well, why don't I go help improve trust in law enforcement now? And it's just like, no matter what it is, he processes it and then takes it to the next level to help other people with his adversity. And I think that's what he's doing here. And I mean, it was refreshing. We're recording this on Friday to see Mike McCarthy and Jerry Jones support that. Because again, I haven't been in the industry that long, but 10, 20 years ago, you're not seeing this type of honesty and vulnerability owned in the same way. And one more thing I would add is when you're like, oh, what are his teammates going to think of him? Well, when someone says that, I think of Michael Gallup, who 18 months prior to Dak also lost a brother to suicide. And if you're Michael Gallup, do you know how much it means to you that now you know this is how someone can own their pain? And Michael owned his too. So I just thought that he handled it with grace, but that's no surprise.
You know what, though, just to add on that, Jory, I thought what was fascinating about it is some of us knew about this early on and chose not to report it. And I had reached out to him the particular day that that news had broke, and I could tell he was not okay. And I had heard he wasn't okay. We don't typically hear him say he's not okay. I mean, when we think about what he went through his rookie year and the way that people have talked about the nuances of this contract and what he deserves or doesn't deserve, he has, I pointed out today on NFL Network, he has such an amazing ability to just compartmentalize everything.
Right.
And so to hear him actually say, I'm struggling with this, I thought it was big. And I think more importantly, people didn't really listen to everything that he said, as typically we don't in this age of Twitter and social media. He talked about how Jace was the primary caregiver of his mother, Peggy, and all right. of the medication he had to give her and watching her get sick, and how he internalized that and probably didn't talk about that enough. And what I got a sense was Dak realizing how destructive that can be. And so I can't even imagine somebody taking that position. Bobby, I don't know your thoughts on this, but it almost feels not that it's, look, I get the bag on Skip. It's been well documented. I couldn't believe how much just the nightly news anchors went in on Skip last night on the 10 o'clock news. I don't know if any of you guys watched that. Yep. And of course we are on Fox Sports Radio, but it just felt like such an interesting take that it makes you wonder, was there something in his own personal life that had Skip go to that place? It was an odd take to have that an opposing defense would weaponize this against a player, and that's why you have a problem with it.
Well, and to basically frame it as not just, you know, he had a problem with the way it was dealt with or whatever, talking about Skip Bayless's reaction to it, but to frame it under as if it's a leadership issue is what was really weird to me. Because I think anybody who, and this was repeated by a ton of people on Thursday, that there are so many criticisms that you can try to level against Dak Prescott. Some of them legitimate, some of them not, some of them up for debate. But realistically, the one area where you can never question is leadership ability, the way guys follow him, the way guys gravitate towards him, and the way he can kind of cultivate, you know, everybody's different personalities together and, you know, press forward. And so it was odd on that front mainly to me. I mean, it was ignorant in general what he said, but to me it was like, you know, this just seems like something that you're trying to frame in a certain way for whatever talking points you need or for whatever content you need. And it's verifiably false, the implications that he derived from it.
Y'all, the logic to me is so ass backwards. That's like saying because Matthew Stafford and his wife, remember when Kelly was going through yep. some of her issues, because they talked about that opposing defense, they're going to weaponize the fact that his wife is dealing with, what was it, a brain tumor? Mm-hmm. No one would ever say that.
Well, that's why I asked Dak yesterday. I'm like, you're so good at blocking out the outside noise, but I think we need to distinguish between that and the voices inside our head, because it's not that Dak's saying like, oh, someone said something to me and I'm going to fold now. It's no, this is real. Mental illness is real. Dak has dealt with a lot of trauma in his life. And even though, I mean, there's nothing credible about the criticism that was there, but it's not that Dak is saying, oh, and I was sad, so now I'm not going to go help my team. He is actually kind of the opposite, that he loves just rising to the occasion and being there. And in quarantine, there were fewer opportunities to do that, which led to this. And then there's just the whole kind of like eerie part that this is happening a couple days before Jace shoots himself. And then Dak has his best night of sleep of 2020 and wakes up to his dad and his best friends in his room telling him like Jace is dead. And I mean, I had obviously nowhere near the amount of interaction with Jace that Dak did, but the few times I didn't meet him, I mean, it was such a sweet teddy bear. I remember I was in Houghton in Dak's hometown. He was doing his camp back there, and I had driven over to the other part of campus to go in because Dak was speaking, and I'm like having trouble backing out my car, and all of a sudden someone comes up to me and they're like, hey, do you want some help? And it's Jace directing me backing out my car. And it's just like those things that, like, this is his brother's camp. We didn't know each other that well, but whether it's that or texting back about like the little ways they would compete about the stories, or I think at his gala last year, I left my notebook. It was actually funny. I had like asked them for something, wrote it in a notebook, and then left it in the bathroom class. Absent-minded me, and like the Dax brothers bring it back to me. They're like, oh, I think you forgot this. And it's just like that to me, it's those little moments when I'm like, this is who they are. They're all just so down to earth. And that's why when they show this vulnerability, it's like, no, we want to confront this because we're not going to let it stop us. And in order for it to not stop us, we need to get help. And that's what Dak did.
Well, and I what I hated the most, it sort of broke my heart yesterday when he said, I got the help that I needed and I dealt with it. You don't just deal with that stuff, you know, like right. You don't deal with the fact, especially when, you know, you made a promise to your dying mother that you guys were going to look out for each other. And I've got to think that there's, you know, parts of Dak that hate that he wasn't able to convince him otherwise, or that he didn't have an idea that was going on in his head. And I mean, that messes with somebody. And we've all dealt with moments of depression and second guessing ourselves in isolation and with COVID. And so I can't even imagine what that's now like on a whole nother level. It's just, I mean, we could talk about this for hours, but I know, Jory, you also have a good relationship with Dak. I say this often, he's worthy of your applause. There are so many people I say you really should never meet your heroes. They will disappoint you. Dak has literally just impressed me time and time again, starting from the time he was where he's never changed. And yeah. He literally never attacks people, goes after them. Sometimes I wish he would defend himself a little bit more. But even on this subject yesterday when he was asked about it, didn't go there. And so it's just, I just have such an immense respect for him. And I think it says a lot about the way he's touched other people, the way people came to his defense. Like, there was such a visceral reaction yesterday, as there should have been.
Oh, when I saw Kevin Love tweeting like Dak saved lives today, is like, that got to me, because I remember seeing when these NBA players really started opening up about their mental health. And it was one, so powerful, but two, we know that the NBA and NFL are a little bit different levels of progressive. And it just, not that no players in the NFL had said something, but it was interesting whether it would become a culture. And I think we saw the NFL take a step in that direction yesterday. And it's just like, it was simultaneously amazing to see Dak be a part of it. And yet in the moment, it just felt so normal, because he does these things so often that, like, I have to step back and be like, wait, yesterday, not everyone was saying this. Or yesterday, all of these sportscasters, athletes, this and that, weren't talking to us about, I mean, even Todd Archer on our beat tweeted about it, how it might have been Dak's finest day on the beat, because he's still dealing with losing a friend to suicide 3 years ago. And he's like, you don't get over that. And it was just like the type of conversations we had yesterday. It was a whole nother level, and it made me so grateful to cover a player like Dak, because, yeah, we like the game of football, but I wasn't like, oh, man, 3 days till the game, and we didn't get a lot about what the receivers are going to do when they all get out there. No, this is what we do. We get to use our platform, and it starts with sports, not ends there, and it was amazing to have Dak participate in that movement.
You know, that's the thing that I think is most interesting about Dak Prescott is that, you know, we talk about what a leader he is and the way he handles himself and how he's remained true to himself. But there's a particular focus within the building for the Cowboys to make sure that guys who come here understand what it means to be a Dallas Cowboy, the optics of being a Dallas Cowboy, the weight of that star and things like that. And that's the thing that I think has always been most, and you've heard Stephen Jones and Jerry Jones and other people reference this consistently, which is he knows how to handle himself. The quarterback position on any team has that kind of pressure on it. But then you extrapolate, you double, triple, whatever it, making it the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys. And he has just been so uniquely equipped to handling those sort of things that are not always easy to handle. And it is one of the things that they always point to when they talk about keeping him long-term. And to that point, talking about keeping him long-term, shifting just a little bit here, you know, you do have that good relationship with Dak. We've all heard the conversations about how the contract negotiations went and his future here, and Jerry saying this week, you know, he's our guy. We want him here. That's now. That's for the future. What's your best guess as to why this didn't get done this offseason? Why are we still sitting here on the franchise tag? Is this strictly you think about negotiations and differences in dollar figures and contract lengths, or is there somebody here on either side who's a little, wants to slow play this a little bit, isn't exactly ready for the long-term commitment to the other?
You bet. I think it's interesting because I'm certainly no billionaire like the Joneses, and so I think you got to respect their business acumen and that Jerry likes to go against the grain, and maybe that's what he's trying to do here. But then you hear Dak say, well, it's not that, 35, 36, whatever it is. It's not so much about the money as it is the respect factor of, I've done everything you've asked of me on and off the field. Okay, has he gotten to a Super Bowl? No. Have most quarterbacks in the league? No. But he wants to be paid fair market value to show that the Joneses respect what he done. And it was actually funny in that sit down with Graham Bensinger. The time I saw him get a little chippy was when they asked about Jerry backing Romo in the middle of his rookie year. And it almost kind of like the way he responded to it, I felt like was so apt for now, because it's like, Jerry, respect me. And again, I think that's where Dak's coming from. But I will say, no question to me do I think that Dak wants to play for the Cowboys. And I do believe, although they're not putting their money where their mouth is, that the Cowboys want Dak to be their quarterback and get what they have. But I did start to wonder a little bit after it didn't get done this year, what was going on? And I know we all know the status since the franchise tag was implemented in 1993, no quarterback has played on that tag and then stayed with the team that drafted them. That's the year Dak was born. I mean, like in his lifetime, this hasn't happened. But then it was funny. I was Zooming with Dak and Zeke this week through one of their Tostitos commercials. And I asked Dak about the Deshaun contract and he kind of smiled and was like, I'm not going to say I'm always right, but I'm confident in what I'm doing. And then I asked Zeke, what would it be like to play in this offense without Dak? And Zeke was like, no way. Like, it's not happening. I'm going to fight for my guy. I mean, it was the emotion. Like, it wasn't so much the words, but just the way he said it. And then we go three or four more questions later. And then Dak is talking about Zeke and how he helps him on the field and just brings it back to, like, I'm not even asking Dak that question. And Dak goes, and like Zeke said, like we're in it for the long haul together, et cetera. And then you pair that with, he's moved his family to North Texas. I do think they're going to figure it out, but I didn't think it would take this long. How about you guys?
I mean, Jory, you and I have talked about my read on this thing. There's been some dispute about that, the 11th hour phone call, but Stephen Jones has confirmed that publicly, that there was this 11th hour push. I got the sense that Dak wanted to get a deal done. And I think you've got to trust the wisdom of your agent and the guy that's what he does. What Dak is so good about is staying in his lane, right? Like, I don't feel like he ever tries to be something he's not. And in this situation, it was relying on Todd France to do his job. I think they just played chicken a little bit too late in the game. And I think ultimately, the way it was described to me, they just couldn't get the deal done. I don't think there was a lack of a desire there. But to be fair, the Cowboys could have, they've never done something before. The best way to show respect to your player is do something you've never done before. Give them the 4-year contract and the $40 million a year, like Deshaun Watson, who has a similar resume. So, look, I think egos.
Oh, yeah.
Got involved.
Not Dax, but yes.
That's my point. I think egos got involved here. And I think what was driving me nuts about the narrative that was out there was that it was Dak's ego and Dak wanted the money. I mean, Dak was just talking. I mean, Dak has told us he was in a hole. He was depressed during all of this. Like,
right.
He was a sports psychologist about stuff that had nothing to do with that contract. I don't believe he was sitting there marinating on the money. He was worried about other things, but he had allowed his agent to handle these negotiations. And I do believe that some egos on both sides, mind you, got involved. The Cowboys are used to you picking up the phone, as we saw with DeMarcus Lawrence and even Rocky Arsenault, Zeke's agent, at the 11th hour to get stuff done. Now, when I say 11th hour, it's 4 or 5 hours or a day before the deadline, not what was characterized to me as it was either, it was definitely 2 hours away from the deadline. I heard 1 hour. So I'll leave it at that. So I think that that is the unfortunate part of it, because I do believe that I was even told Dak was advised not to sign the franchise tag because they wanted a bargaining chip. And Dak was the one that said, nope, I want to sign this franchise tag. He wants to be here. So I think that's what's unfortunate, but I think it's helped that they've waited a year, because now we're seeing what the Patrick Mahomes contract did and what the Deshaun Watson contract did. So, I mean, he stands to make 37.5 on the franchise tag. Why wouldn't the Cowboys pay him at least $40 million next year?
And here's the curious thing to me, is that we consistently heard, going back to last summer when he became available to be able to negotiate an extension, rules allowed him to do so. There was this talk of, okay, get it done before Wentz and Goff. And then those got done. And then it was, okay, we'll just get it done before Watson and Mahomes next offseason. And then Watson and Mahomes. Now we're looking at, okay, get it done next offseason early enough that you're not competing against, you know, reigning MVP Lamar Jackson's deal. And who knows how Josh Allen and Baker Mayfield and Sam Darnold and these guys are going to grow this year, and then you'll be competing against those. And this market just continues to go up, and then you're competing against a TV deal. My thing is that when you look at the big extensions they've done, they have not really, I don't think, won one. I don't think people would say the Cowboys have won a big extension since Tyron Smith, which is 6 years ago. And I don't know why this is the one at the most important position, that this is the one that they're really trying to dig in and win.
I truly believe if he had a different agent, it would have gotten done. I'm dead serious.
That's probably part of it. The Cowboys, I've said this before on here, the Cowboys I know have said privately before to people that that is one of their least favorite agents to deal with.
And when I think of the timeline, I think of two things. One, a stat I saw this week was, since the beginning of April 2019, 7 quarterbacks have signed new deals that average at least $32 million a year. And obviously we're seeing 32, 33, 35, 39, 45, or whatever Mahomes is at. So it's going up. And then I think about training camp 2019, and around September 2019, as we all know, is when Steven says that's the closest they were. Like, right as that season started, they thought they were going to get there. And Steven's saying in training camp, we're damn sure not resetting the market. And then what do you know? They reset the market with Zeke. And although Amari, I get that there's not after 2 years, the max value, they reset the market there. So I don't know. It's like, on one hand, those guys got the deal done, but the agents
in all of those situations, Jory, picked up the phone. They had no communication with Todd France.
Right. I know. The spring is very quiet.
Like, everyone is fascinated by that. I'm like, there was no communication. So I think you got, for lack of a better word, a little pee match between the two. And I think they ended up both suffering, quite frankly. But unfortunately, the person who suffered the most is Dak. And you hope that Dak doesn't get injured this year. Obviously, he's got insurance and all of those things. But if there was ever a player, to your point, Jory, that deserved to get overpaid, it was that guy.
Right.
I want to put a hypothetical out there for you guys. And I'm not putting this on Zeke. This is just his agent being smart. Zeke gets paid 2 years ahead of time, which, if you look at what happened with Todd Gurley and you look at what happened with Leonard Fournette, he probably would not have gotten that contract if he'd tried to negotiate this year or next year, right?
Yep.
Is there in any way a possibility that because that happened, that hurt the leverage Dak had? And would Dak have been more successful if he'd actually done what Zeke did and hold out last summer with Zeke? Right.
Yeah, I mean, squeaky wheel.
I mean, I respect Dak for not doing it.
Well, I mean, yeah, squeaky wheel gets the oil. So, yeah, Zeke holds out.
And DeMarcus, too. I'm not having shoulder surgery until you give me this contract.
Exactly. There are certain aspects of – and maybe that's where Dak misplayed it a little bit. As we heard consistently Dak saying that, you know, I believe we're going to get it done. You know, I believe in my agent and I believe in the Cowboys that they're going to get this done. And you know, this will be a fair deal for everyone. And now he's talking about, you know, respect. And things like
which
that.
Which I love.
Yeah, I do too.
I personally feel like he needed to say that sooner, because if you listen to DeMarcus Ware and you listened to even Ezekiel Elliott, They talked about why they should get paid more.
Right.
Whereas Dak just always respectfully, and this goes back to even our conversation that we started with, he never, ever comes out and blasts people. And sometimes I want him to come out in defense of himself sometimes even, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the one thing. I just feel like if he had played a little bit more hardball and if he either had a different agent or an agent that picked up the phone the way that Cantor did, the way that Rocky Arsenault did, there's a level with the Cowboys where they sort of want you to bend the knee a little bit. They do.
Yeah, and like I say, in other instances, they end out losing. They lose with DeMarcus Lawrence. They lose with Ezekiel Elliott. Jalen Smith is a deal they probably aren't totally thrilled with at this moment. Maybe that changes if he, turns things around this year. And so it's just odd that the only other time we've ever seen a team handle their quarterback situation, their franchise quarterback situation in recent history the same way was Washington. And that is one of the most dysfunctional franchises in this league. And there's not a single way I think you'd want to be compared to Washington after this entire summer. And yet that's who Dallas operated like. And it's like, man, that's a culture of losing that has taken place in Washington for so long that it's just, it's fascinating that that's the way, that's the route you take.
With that being said too, though, just to play devil's advocate here, they offered him 34 and a half a year plus $110 million guaranteed is what I was told. That's like right around the Russell Wilson, Jared Goff. And when you look at all the pieces that they've got around Dak, those are pieces that guys like Russell Wilson don't have. And guys like Alex Smith certainly didn't have. I do agree. There is this notion that you can't go to a Super Bowl if you're overpaying at certain positions. Now, I agree that it's, like, not my problem, the way that DeMarcus Lawrence said a couple of years ago. Like, I get that logic and that frustration, but I do understand that this year there was a number that they could get up to if they wanted to keep all of these moving parts here. And I do believe, and I don't think it's a fair logic, but I look at Amari Cooper and his deal, and he is literally downtown decorating one of the high-rises with his Gatorade spot. Like, there are endorsements that come to you when you are especially the quarterback of the Cowboys, but even more importantly, the quarterback of a Super Bowl winning Cowboy. And again, I don't think it's fair to say, well, we're going to shortchange you here to get this done, or you should give a hometown discount. But I do see some of the sides there. I just think I think Dak hit the nail on the head the other day. Both sides are going to have to give a little bit.
Sure. And I think that's exactly where we're at. But I would also guess that on Todd France's side or whoever would be the negotiator on Dak's side, which you remember, we talked about the deal with David Cantor. David Cantor says, well, Cowboys fans can hate me too. If I was Dak's agent, I would have told them go jump in a lake too. And he says I think that when it comes to quarterbacks, those things don't move the needle for them. Look at sponsorship opportunity, because you can point to Aaron Rodgers and say Aaron Rodgers is on national commercials in the smallest market in the NFL. And if you are star quarterback, you'll get those opportunities regardless. And so that's why it may be harder for Dallas to sell a guy like Dak on those. But Jory, go ahead. I know I interrupted you there.
Oh, no, you're good. Yeah, and I mean, again, I heard a little bit different numbers, but as we always know, there's at least three sides to every story.
What numbers were you told, Jory?
I need to, like, look back at my notes, but it was not 34 and a half a year. Certainly the whole, and I think we're probably in agreement on this, like 5 years versus 4 years. But, like, I want to say it was much closer to, like, that 33 Goff range. Like, it wasn't more than Goff, and it wasn't going to be for 4 years, per the average, the guarantees. Like, that was kind of a sticking point that I heard, is that you have Goff and Wentz, who got it done last year, and they did it for 4 years, which, again, if you're the Cowboys, you can say, but there were deals left. But still, it's the extension, and the Cowboys could have done it in 2019. So my understanding was it was a big thing of, like, why are we trying to get – Goff Wentz averages per year, 4 years or for 5 years when we want four, no more guarantees, when, like, the market has moved. So again, I think it's probably somewhere between. I also think one point of nuance that I heard, which it's been some time now, was, is this a number that we're talking about that was on that phone call at the deadline on July 15th, or is this a written offer? And if it was just a phone call an hour or two before the deadline, how serious is that? Because, like, they had to have the deal done by that 3 o'clock, whatever it was, right, July 15th deadline. So I don't know. It's interesting. And again, I think that, like, probably both of them are true in different ways. And, like, there's just so much nuance to this, but that was where I heard the respect factor came in.
I could see that.
And I know Jane and I heard separately because we had discussed this at the time. I know Jane and I heard separately about not different things. We heard the same thing from separate people about the initial thing that Dallas offered up last summer was inadequate. How much do you think, if that's the same that you heard, how much of do you think potentially whatever inadequacy there was with the initial offer may have damaged things to the point that it wasn't able to all be ironed out over the course of a year?
You know, I think it probably affected it last year. And again, to whatever degree Dak was going high because they were going low in terms of the initial numbers. I don't think that's what the spring was about. I think that there, like Jane was saying, there just wasn't a lot of conversation because it wasn't that they were having these conversations. And again, from what I know, I wasn't there. It's not that I'm hearing, oh, they talked in April, May, and June, and they're like, well, you said this last July, and that was disrespectful, so we're going to do this. I just don't think they were talking. And then I also think that there's a part of Dak's camp that says, okay, if he's going to make 37.7 on the franchise tag last year or next year, and then on top of that, given all these like franchise tag minutia rules, he can never be on the first franchise tag again because I guess the second one has to be 120% the price of the first one. So no matter what team he's with, if somehow he's not with the Cowboys, his earning power goes up forever in the NFL because he got that, he burned off that first franchise tag. So I think that they were using that as a factor that if we're trying to get our guy the money and he's going to be here and it's in the Cowboys' best interest to keep him here, we don't have to, it's not zero or 31. I mean, that was a factor that I was hearing.
I just think the biggest thing is like Kirk Cousins, obviously a guy that mirrored a lot of this. I'm like, he's just such an outlier how that worked out for him. You know, like, right. I don't know if I would have just like banked on necessarily all of that. At the end of the day, though, I would be very, very shocked, barring a complete breakdown by Dak Prescott this year and problems with him and his coach, which I would literally bet my life savings on it. That won't be an issue. I would be very, very shocked if he is not the guy in Dallas and a deal is reached. But last summer, I was like, oh, this deal's getting done. It'll be him, then Amari Cooper, then Zeke. And I couldn't have been more wrong. So,
yeah, we'll see. All of us.
Yeah, that's the thing. We all, every step of the way, have gone, it'll get done before training camp. It'll get done before the season. Well, it'll get done next. So, who knows? Yeah, I bet we're all sitting here in 2022 going, man, that Bill Belichick, Dak Prescott pairing, it's just awesome there in New England, isn't it?
But what you say about the Mike McCarthy partnership, and again, personally, my interactions with Aaron Rodgers have been very positive. But what we hear, I think he just has a very different demeanor than Dak. So if you're coaching Aaron Rodgers, then you go to Dak and you're saying, like, can these guys get along? Like, if you can get along with Aaron Rodgers, I think you can get along with Dak. And I respect both of them a lot.
I find Mike McCarthy, he's kind of a smart ass, and I love it. Like, I absolutely love the zings. I like, because Stephen Jones will give you the same sort of demeanor. It still feels like they're brothers. Like, he is more Stephen's kin than even Jerry Jones Jr. is. Like, those two remind me so much of each other.
Stephen and McCarthy look a little alike. If you look at, like, young Stephen and young McCarthy, there's some similarity. Which, by the way, to your point, I do love. I had messaged somebody on the Green Bay beat that I know right after they hired McCarthy, and I was just like, hey, just curious, what's he like dealing with on the thing? And the reply back was, he's Pittsburgh as hell. And I said, what does that mean? And they said, you'll find out. And yeah, that's turned out to be a pretty good descriptor. Pittsburgh is hell.
Okay, when we're talking about his zingers, we can't talk about his zingers without acknowledging what happened to you in the press conference.
Oh, yeah, where he's like,
because I know, and if whoever's listening to this, even if you're following the Cowboys, you probably could have heard the press conference and you could see McCarthy, but you can't see us. And like, straight up, we have this technology that has been malfunctioning for weeks, despite this being the most valuable franchise in the world. And then it's like, we're trying to figure out these speakers. So picture, like, I'm up in the front because they're like Jory mumbles. We need to get her close to the speaker. Jane's in the back and you come up. And then literally when Mike was like, I'm not an expert on this, but based off the tendencies I'm seeing, I think you're talking too close to the speaker. I'm like, he is scouting this, like, the way we are reporting now, and it's still not working. But I was like, the fact that he said, I see that he was observing the tendencies, I could not.
The analytics conversion is true.
Next to me. I mean, I was wearing my mask. I'm like removing my mask. I'm like leaning into the speaker. Cause I'm like, oh, I'm not going to have this delay. Like, we're not, this isn't good. And then it's like back up. And I'm like, sorry, coach. Like, I'm at the back of the classroom. I find him wildly entertaining, and he always gives us really interesting, complete answers. They're thoughtful ones. But I
always completed.
I was about to say, unless you ask about Amari or something.
I don't know these physical ailments.
They're completely dancing around things. But here's what I'll say. He's maddening for us reporters. I've never been more frustrated than when he removed those jersey numbers and names at the blue and white scrimmage game. But if you're a Cowboy fan and a player, you've got to love the fact that I'll just put it this way. I had three Super Bowl winning coaches reach out to me and say, we didn't know about this rule that we didn't have to put jersey numbers and names on the jerseys. And I was like, wait, what? Bill Belichick had done this in OTAs. And then the Ravens complained about it. And then the Ravens in the league decided that that was a new rule. And so you could not have players at practice because that was when you could, like, if you had a player that was hurt, you could substitute them. And so it was a great game plan by Bill Belichick, but it didn't hold any water. So when I reached out to the league and I was like, can Mike do this? They're like, oh yeah, the new rule is until September 7th. I was like, oh, we're already doing a little game.
Okay, and then also on those rules, what about the fact that, okay, so as reporters, we can no longer watch the whole practice now like we do in training camps. We get 30-ish minutes, but they've set it up so the quarterbacks work inside on their quarterback school. We're outside, and the day we went to practice, I guess Wednesday, because Thursday is a little bit different, we were walking back to go there because they said practice access was over, and there had been no sign of Dak Prescott, no sign of Andy Dalton, and we're like, oh, no quarterbacks. Like, who knows? Like, what if it was last year and he was still injured? And then another little tweak like that, okay, last year also. We were going to practice Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Well, McCarthy has this whole like sports science situation where it's workload Thursday, recovery and soft tissue, something or another Friday. And then on Saturday, you're doing your neurological activation, but we're not allowed out there Saturday. And again, me personally, I don't work on Saturdays. Gotta love the Sabbath. But I was talking to another reporter on the beat and they're like, how does he get away with like cutting us down from three practices to two, no quarterback? And I'm like, I think if you're trying to fight it, you got to go back to Green Bay and figure out, were those reporters at practice on Saturday? Because a lot of things this year are, we wish we could show you this too, but there's a pandemic going on. And I'm like,
That's the factor.
You know, that's how'd you know? Like, that's why you didn't show it to us last year, maybe the year before.
Maybe it returns to normal when we get done with pandemic. You know, but way. I will say that every time, like, anybody asks, like, McCarthy about the status of an injury, it's like vividly reminds me of like when I ask my son about like why homework didn't get turned in, and it's like, what's homework? You know,
His go-to is, I didn't hear the question.
Yeah.
But what about when we asked if he would kneel during the anthem? He's like, are we done here? And granted, again, the technology wasn't working that day. I'm not saying it couldn't have been a tech factor, but at some point, if this happens 10 times very conveniently, you got to be skeptical as a reporter.
And he's a worthy adversary. I look forward. He's forced me to step my game up. I actually love it.
Well, and then what was I about to say? Oh, with Amari's injury and that Sunday blue-white scrimmage, we're at AT&T Stadium. Someone asked about Amari. He's like, oh, numbers. And I literally said, so as it relates to Amari Cooper's health, do you have any concerns? Like, you probably should have concerns about him. And he's like, I have no concerns. And then 2 days later, it's like,
we
look at the numbers. He's been in the league a while. And then if you're Amari, you're like, it's fine. This is just like who we are. But I'm like, you can't get away with it. That's why when we talked to him, the offensive line coach, this is weeks ago when Cam Irving wasn't in practice and no one would say anything about his absence. And I was like, hey, Joe, thanks for your time. How's Cam doing? What's his progress and why hasn't he been practicing? Just hoping that someone else, if you just asked it directly, would answer. And he's like, yeah, I'm not going to comment on that. And I'm like, is anyone going to comment on anything in the year 2020?
You know, that's the worst part about losing locker access is the fact that we've lost Amari Cooper's totally like open explanation of every injury where it's like, hey, Amari, what are you dealing with? And he's like, let me show you my bruise. So I talked to the doctor and they said that the way the muscles break, like Amari is always like, great to ask about his injury. So we've kind of lost that ability this year.
I know. I've been trying to text a couple guys and be like, hey, really miss being able to come by your locker.
Back to you.
Okay. Most of them, I had one guy getting back to me for a little bit, but for the most part, it'll be like completely non-competitive things like chess questions. And yeah, it's a little bit different than last year. I'll tell you.
I had an undrafted free agent
in June whose agent was like, yeah, we were told to like stop talking to reporters and lay a little lower. And I'm like,
I was beginning to wonder if these guys had just lost my number, changed numbers, but I can't get players to get back to me either. And to your point, innocuous questions.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not asking them about game plans, another player, and like nothing. So again, maddening as a reporter, I'm leaning in as most of us are with workflow and the changes that come with COVID, but it does make it very, very hard to do your job. If I'm a Cowboys fan, I'm excited though, because it did feel like there was a whole lot of information out there as it related to this team that people, opposing teams, would use against him.
Yeah. I miss those walk-offs, though, that we would have with Jason Garrett.
Yeah. Lots of great info there. But again, as Jane said, everybody adjusting, raising their game, and Jory's included in that. So if you want, go follow Jory on Twitter, at Jory Epstein. It's Epstein, not Epstein. I'm clearing things up. I'm clearing things up for Jory here, since everybody seems to be Epstein. But it's Epstein.
It was a cathartic moment.
Yes, Epstein. Jory Epstein on Twitter. Give her a follow. Jory, thanks so much.
All right, so next time we come to you, we'll be breaking down this game. Will the Cowboys be 0-1 or 1-0 to start the season?
Yeah, it's one that I feel good about. I think they are going to take this one. But again, as we talked about with Omar and Jory, and you and I have talked so much about, there's so much uncertainty about what these teams even look like right now that it's really difficult to project much of anything. But I think from a talent standpoint, this is a game that, you know, Dallas should be in good shape.